Welcome to Open Spaces. From Wyoming Public Radio News, I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Today on the show, landowners in southeast Wyoming allege a massive oil and gas company has taken minerals from them without consent. They're now suing Anadarko for millions.
We're going to come in. We're going to do what we want. This is what we did. You'll have to live with it.
The Wyoming football team has had to battle a number of injuries leading into the Arizona Bowl.
When Sean got hurt, relative to his play, we were climbing, and you do take a step back.
A proposed new degree program at Central Wyoming College would train students to be experts in tribal leadership.
This will be an option for us to take and get our education without leaving the reservation, without leaving our families and relocating to a different lifestyle.
Join us for those stories and more on Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News.
Welcome to Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. If you own land with minerals underneath in Wyoming, an operator normally approaches you and negotiates a deal where they drill and you get top dollar. However, a situation has arisen in southeast Wyoming where a company has found a way to avoid that process and control minerals they don't own. Now, 36 affected landowners have filed a lawsuit against the company in question, Anadarko Petroleum. They allege Anadarko has unfairly taken their minerals and created a monopoly in their county. The lawsuit's results could have implications on Wyoming statutes, the oil and gas market, and people's wallets. Wyoming Public Radio's Cooper McKim reports.
Close to the Nebraska border in eastern Laramie County, vast swaths of farmland give way to a property neatly outlined by silos and rehabbed farm buildings. An American flag welcomes visitors to the main house.
Good to meet you, man. Ron Rabo.
Yeah, nice to see you.
I'm here to visit Ron Rabo on his farm. He's one of 35 parties in the area suing Anadarko Petroleum. Most of the plaintiffs, like Rabo, are farmers and ranchers. But before getting into that, Rabo wanted to explain how this property came to be. He says his great-great-grandmother homesteaded here in 1905. He's since transformed it from a little operation to a huge one, with way more crops. In fact, he's had to change a lot.
We've had to reinvent who we are, what we do, and why we do it. What we've developed and built on this farm is our ability to gain assets that have marketability and profitability potential for us. And so minerals, obviously, are a part of that. For this operation, that's been stolen, it's been taken away.
To stabilize the uncertain farmer lifestyle, Rabo's diversified his crops, opened a hunting lodge, advertised corporate retreats. He also invested in parcels of land with likely incredibly valuable minerals underneath, hoping to one day pull them from the ground. Many other farmers and ranchers took a similar tack. But due to Anadarko and their actions over the past decade, it's looking more and more unlikely that they'll reap the benefits. Rabo jumps into a truck to show me the land in question. Okay, so here's what happened according to the complaint filed in court. Anadarko bought up land and minerals surrounding many landowners. It then used its position to take control of minerals that weren't their own. It now controls minerals in more than half the county. They used broad horizontal drilling permits to do it, which Rabo and affected landowners fought hard to stop through hearings at the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission. Rabo says Anadarko didn't even try to negotiate with him.
It had nothing to do with that at all. It had everything to do with, we're going to come in, we're going to do what we want, this is what we did, you'll have to live with it.
Rabo pulls to the side of the road with little else but farmland in view, shaded red and blue from the sunset. He jumps out of the car and into leftover snow. This is where Rabo Farms grows winter wheat. It also holds minerals.
So this is some of the land that is tied up.
Even if Rabo wanted to lease out his minerals and make some money, he'd be at a distinct disadvantage because of this whole permitting debacle. We jump back in the car, and Rabo says it feels like a crop has been taken from him.
When you have additional assets on your land, that you have an opportunity to one day, hopefully, be able to say, you know what, this is maybe an opportunity that we have to pay some debt off. This is maybe an opportunity that we have to expand our place.
But Rabo says that's not possible. So he joined the lawsuit to take a stand. The lead attorney representing landowners is noted litigator Bob Schuster of Jackson. He explains Anadarko has indeed taken control of the majority of Laramie County's minerals, but it hasn't actually drilled a well since 2013 in the county.
What they have done is locked up this land so that it can't be leased, it can't be drilled. That hurts the landowners. It hurts Laramie County. It hurts the state of Wyoming.
And Schuster says he considers that a monopoly, which is not legal. Okay, so Anadarko has all this land. But you might be wondering, why can't some other operator just come in and develop if Anadarko isn't going to do it? Well, they could. But a plaintiff court filing argues Anadarko has found a way to keep competitors out. It says, as the landowner and operator, Anadarko leased the land to itself at a royalty rate above market standards. In other words, attorneys say other competitors wouldn't be interested because it would cost more than normal to drill there. So, to recap, it's taken a bunch of land, it hasn't drilled there since 2013, and it doesn't seem to want anyone else to drill. All that, by the way, according to the plaintiff's complaint.
They care about their asset and maximizing the value of it. And in this case, they have tried to maximize that illegally because it's illegal to have monopoly power. It's illegal to have such control that you then overwhelm your neighbors and they can't exercise their own rights.
A company called Occidental Petroleum acquired Anadarko this year in a blockbuster sale. Neither responded to requests for an interview, but one representative did say in a statement, quote, "We believe the litigation is without merit and intend to vigorously defend it," unquote. The company has yet to file a response in court, so fully understanding their position is still difficult. For Schuster and the landowners, there's another problem in all this. It could happen again. Some have already heard of it happening elsewhere. Because all the maneuvers Anadarko used to assert itself as Laramie County's operator could not have happened without Wyoming statute behind it. Rules which allow companies to lease to themselves and permit thousands of acres of land with no intent to drill. The second one, though, the Wyoming Oil and Gas Conservation Commission is working to fix. Schuster says these statutes are a problem in this case. With the current system, companies can flood the commission with permit applications and gain control over an area, tying it up for years. And while none of this is challenged legally, Schuster says they do need to be changed.
But those people hopefully will pay attention and hopefully will then take corrective measures so that this doesn't happen in the future, because it shouldn't happen in the future. It's wrong.
Tom Kropatch says the commission is following this lawsuit. He's the deputy supervisor of the WOGCC, which oversees these statutes.
You know, we would just wait till those decisions come out, and if something needs to be revised, then we'd work towards that.
This lawsuit could have market impacts, too. Carl Larry is a market specialist with Refinitiv, a financial data provider. If Anadarko was selling parcels to itself at an inflated value, Larry says that could create an economic bubble. If Anadarko lost the case and the bubble popped, he says it could be devastating, considering how low energy prices are and the lack of foreign demand.
Well, I don't think the industry can handle something like this. We could see other people questioning other companies and their lease sales within their subsidiaries. So it could be this domino effect where, at a worst case scenario, this could just really crush the industry.
As far as the case's outcome, University of Wyoming Associate Law Professor Tara Rigetti says there's no obvious answer. She is not involved in this case. Rigetti says while it's clear landowners have struggled for control of its minerals, that doesn't mean they're right legally.
Exactly. I would say just because something disadvantages a party doesn't necessarily mean that there's a remedy.
And whoever the court ends up siding with, the other side is likely to file an appeal. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Cooper McKim.
Several community colleges in our state are in the process of developing four-year Bachelor of Applied Science degree programs. One proposed degree at Central Wyoming College, or CWC, would help students learn what it takes to be a good tribal leader. Wyoming Public Radio's Savannah Marr reports on what that could mean for the Wind River Reservation.
It's the last day of the semester at the Wind River Tribal College in Ifetee. Dr. Teresa Spoonhunter's Federal Indian Law class starts in 10 minutes, and she's in the kitchen cooking a big pot of chicken noodle soup.
To me, this is kind of my treat for them surviving this semester and making it to the end and You never send your warriors hungry, so.
Spoon Hunter is a professor of American Indian Studies at CWC, but she teaches many of her courses here at the Tribal College building. When she calls her students warriors, she means it. They come to class to learn about their power as Native people, their sovereignty, their treaty rights, things Spoon Hunter says not enough tribal members are formally educated about.
But yet, it's the foundation of everything that we deal with. When we wake up, we're sick, we gotta go to IHS. That's from our treaty right. You know, we gotta go to school, my kids. Why do we have to go to school? Because, you know, that's treaty right. We wanna make sure that you're educated so that you can protect our home, our land, our children.
The rules around tribal governance, tribal resource management, things you need to know to be an effective tribal leader are complicated and specific. That's why Spoon Hunter and others at CWC have been fighting hard to get a new degree program accredited, a 4-year Bachelor of Applied Science in Tribal Leadership. Spoon Hunter let me visit her federal Indian law class so I could see for myself why that new degree would matter so much. On this final day, Latana Snyder is giving a presentation on a Supreme Court decision regarding the Tihitan tribe of Tlingit people in Alaska.
The reason why I picked this was because this is kind of like across Indian country, like how they say that we're not recognized, like the land's not ours. We're free to live here as long as we want, but we just can't ever own the land. And so that's why I picked this one.
Like a lot of Spoon Hunter students, Snyder is a tribal employee. She heads up the Human Resources Department for the Northern Arapaho tribe. But much of the material in the American Indian Studies courses she's taken has been brand new to her.
I felt like every tribal employee should have taken those classes because it gives you an insight on, you know, kind of the laws and what we can and cannot do.
She says the Eastern Shoshone and Northern Arapaho tribes need more employees who are formally educated on tribal governance. But for a lot of folks on Wind River, that kind of education is out of reach. Take Rose Trosper, who works in the HR department with Snyder. After she finished her associate's degree at CWC, she says that felt like the end of the line for her.
Because I have a family, I have a home here, like everything's here, my job. It wouldn't be easy for me to just pick up and leave and, you know, go somewhere to go to school.
If all goes as planned, CWC's proposed BAS degree will allow students to get their bachelor's without leaving Fremont County, maybe without leaving the reservation. And that could help graduates advance their careers within tribal government. Trosper and Snyder are both part of a small cohort who are pursuing bachelor's degrees through a partnership between the Wind River Tribal College and the University of Wisconsin Oshkosh, and they're both close to graduating. Otherwise, they say the BAS in tribal leadership would have been right up their alley, and they hope other tribal members take advantage.
We're going to have that option, where our options have been limited for a really long time. This will be an option for us to take and get our education without leaving the reservation, without leaving our families and relocating to a different lifestyle.
The Federal Higher Learning Commission visited CWC's campus earlier this month to evaluate whether the college is ready to offer this degree program. CWC President Brad Tindall says they asked a lot of questions about the college's academic master plan, student affairs, how the degree fits in with community needs.
They wanted to know if we have enough parking lot space. We do. Do we have enough classroom space? We do. And so we demonstrated all these things. And so overall, I think we have a very high probability of approval. And hopefully I don't have to eat my words later, but I'm feeling pretty optimistic.
Dr. Spoon Hunter and the rest of the American Indian Studies team were part of that evaluation process.
And there was a question that totally stumped us, and it was, what if you fail? And it was dead silence. You know, like nobody even like thought of failing, right?
Because they see firsthand how badly Wind River wants this option, how hungry their students are to get an education and become leaders in their tribes.
As Native people, we have suffered so much that even if we fail, we learn and we get up and we try again. And to me, one student getting a degree is enough for celebration.
And whether the Higher Learning Commission approves the degree or not, they're expected to make a call in the spring. Spoon Hunter says she'll keep fighting to make sure tribal leaders have the tools they need to protect what's theirs. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Savannah Marr on the Wind River Reservation.
Savannah Marr is a Report for America Corps member.
When we come back, we will talk with the offensive coordinator of the University of Wyoming football team, Brent Vegan. This is Open Spaces.
Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Maggie Mullen.
And I'm Bob Beck. As the University of Wyoming football team struggled down the stretch on offense, few people took it harder than offensive coordinator Brent Vegan. In fairness, he was in a tough spot. He'd lost a number of offensive linemen, two running backs, and his starting quarterback due to injuries. As the Cowboys prepare to play in the Arizona Bowl, Vegan tells me that the silver lining is that a lot of young players just missed winning a couple of huge games and that the future of Cowboy football is bright. However, the season certainly did not go as planned.
Well, it's certainly uneven from that standpoint. You know, I know we'll look back and say, boy, when we had everybody out there, we were this. But, you know, that's part of the game. You know, you deal with injuries, and it typically happens in bunches at particular spots. And for us this year, it happened kind of in three spots. And our position with the most depth receiver, we really didn't get anybody hurt. So it's the nature of it. I think what you look back at is, were we in position to win each game? Did we prepare our guys each week with that mindset? Did we have a good plan? Did the guys play hard? You know, and I think we could say every week that was the case. Now, a few games we turned the ball over, and that killed us. A few games we had to kick too many field goals or attempt too many field goals, and that killed us. I think what we'll have to really preach to the guys in the off season is, guys, okay, close is not what we're aiming for. You know, winning these games and finding a way to close games out in the fourth quarter is what we need to find a way to do a better job of. And, you know, I think our guys will adhere to that and keep working and put another year in the weight room behind them, and we'll see where that can take us in the years to come.
I've decided after reading social media over the last few years in my career that I never want to be an offensive or a defensive coordinator in my life, but you get second-guessed a lot. That's all part of it, I understand. But do you ever second-guess yourself? Do you go back and go, wow, I wonder if we had done this a little differently?
Well, I think you self-reflect. You always do. And, you know, if you had a crystal ball and knew exactly what the other guy was thinking and what he was going to do, and you certainly prepare with that in mind, but you make the calls that you have planned to do, that you've prepared to do. You try not to stray from that plan, but sometimes there's things out of your control that happen. So, I don't know. I wouldn't call it second guessing, but to not look back and be critical of the way you do things is remiss. You got to try to get better. And sometimes you do that maybe a little bit more at the end of the season when you look back. But, you know, certainly as you go through the year, you look at each game with a critical eye and try to get better for sure.
But you develop a plan probably around Sean's skills. He gets hurt, and you go to Tyler, who's a completely different quarterback. That had to cause some adjustment.
It did. You know, I think where we were at when Sean got hurt, relative to his play, we were climbing. And you do take a step back, and, you know, it's been a little bit of an up-and-down deal the last four games. We haven't won but one of them, and that's the frustrating part, because I think we were positioned to win all four of them. And, you know, here we sit with one more opportunity, and that's really what, at this point in time, it's got to be about. Go out there and do everything we can to get an eighth victory, and then, you know, probably reassess things a little bit more, get these guys back in the weight room and getting ready for spring ball, but that's down the road yet.
We'll talk about the bowl game in just a second, but on the bright side of everything we've talked about, you got to play a lot of people, and especially on the offensive line, and guys that had maybe some surprising success to you.
Yeah, you know, if you would have said back in the spring when we had Coach Miller going that you're going to play 11 guys, and he's probably going to say, where are these 11 guys coming from? But that's, you know, yeah, I think it's been good. I think some guys have really had really taken their game to another level. And unfortunately, we haven't had those guys all the way through. You know, some young guys that we probably, back in the spring, you know, Frank Crum probably comes to mind the most. You know, he's showing that he's going to be a guy that we can count on. you know, getting Latrell Bible, a true freshman, some experience. He's got to put some weight on, but he's going to be a guy that can play for us. And those things maybe wouldn't happen if we would have stayed completely healthy. It's the positive part of playing guys and getting experience is that, you know, come next year, come the 2020 season, those guys, you know, playing is going to be second nature to them as far as being out on that field.
How surprised were you with Xavian's effort this year? I mean, the guy's out there, he's playing hurt. You really don't have, you almost had to come to the press box and get me to carry a few of runs, which would not have been a good thing. How impressed were you with him and maybe even surprised?
Well, I think you could see his mentality, the way he went about things last winter, really, in the weight room. And he was real intent on, you know, putting another 10 pounds on, getting stronger. So you could see it back then that there was a guy that was going to be different. Now, as we started the season and we were playing three guys, we certainly wouldn't have guessed it would have come to what it had the last half of the season. And you know, when Titus went down game six and we were looking at the prospect of at least playing four games with just one guy, I didn't know how we were going to do it. And then it became six. And X answered the bell, and I think he answered the bell because he knew he had to. You know, he didn't answer the bell because he felt 100%. You know, and when that happens, you know that a guy is all in, he's bought in. And I think he can be that example that, all right, this is what it's all about to be part of this team. No different than like a Nico Evans last year, different story, but he sat there by this time, hung in there, and then exploded on the scene, you know, and at that position, that's a position that can be featured in our offense, but it certainly takes on different forms. So really pleased with X and really looking forward more than anything that, you know, he's going to be as healthy come December 31st as he's been in a long, long time.
Looking at the bowl game, looking at Georgia State, what strikes you with their defense? What are you expecting?
Well, they're 3-4. There's different styles of 3-4 that you can play, and theirs is one that they're going to move their front. At least that's what they've shown consistently throughout the year. You know, their strength is their guys up front, and I hope come the 31st we can say our strength is our guys up front. So that matchup is one we have to win, and you know, to do that, you know, we got to play like we have at. For the most part this season up front. And you know, that comes in the run game, that comes in the protection. And, you know, I know they're a program that hasn't had tons of opportunities to play in the postseason, so I'm sure they're thrilled to be there, and as are we. And you know, the anticipation is that we're going down there to win a football game. I think our guys understand that this is fun and games to some point, but it's a lot more fun to get on that plane with a game one for sure.
Brent Beacon, always a pleasure. Thank you.
All right, thanks for having me.
When we come back, you can join me on a hunt for a Christmas tree. This is Open Spaces.
This is Open Spaces from Wyoming Public Radio News. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Winters in Norway usually last from October to late May. Sound familiar? Norway also has something called the polar night. For about 2 months, the sun never rises above the horizon, giving way to some of the longest, darkest winters on Earth. But to psychologists' surprise, rates of seasonal depression there are extremely low for what one would expect. That's why Stanford researcher Carrie Leibowitz went there to learn more. She tells me about what she found in a town called Tromsø.
I sort of showed up asking the question, why aren't people more depressed, even though it's so dark? And it really took, you know, a few months of my living there and talking to people to realize that I was asking totally the wrong question. But I was talking to a friend of mine there. Her name is Fern, and she's actually from Australia and now lives in Tromsø. And she was asking me sort of how long I plan to stay. And I told her, you know, I was hoping to stay through as much of the summer as possible because it would be a shame to have made it all the way through the winter just to leave right before the best season. And she just responded and said, I wouldn't necessarily say that summer is the best season. And that to me was, you know, maybe it shouldn't have been so profound, but it really was because, you know, Tromsø really only has two seasons. It basically has this winter and this summer. It has very condensed falls and springs. But Fern sort of, you know, put it very plainly that she preferred the winter. And this was someone who had come from Australia. And so I sort of started thinking that, okay, this whole framework of trying to understand why people aren't more depressed might not be the right approach. There haven't really been a lot of studies of people enjoying or appreciating the winter. And that's where we decided to come up with a measure to try and measure people's mindsets about winter as a way to have there be more room for however people feel about the winter. If they feel negatively, you know, the mindset measure could capture that. But if they felt positively, it could capture that as well.
Yeah, so tell me a little bit about how folks in Tromsø, how they sort of spin their winters differently than a lot of us in the U.S.
Norwegians all over the country, but particularly in Tromsø, really value time spent outdoors. They say that Norwegians are born with skis on their feet, so people love when it snows. There's also sort of this ability to appreciate the winter for the opportunities it offers to be inside as well. So this concept of kuselig, which is the Norwegian equivalent of the Danish hygge, which you might be familiar with, is this idea of coziness, of making this sort of a special, peaceful, contemplative, sort of warm, loving time. And so it's really about this sort of spirit of feeling safe and peaceful and cared for. And that permeates the entire season.
Knowing what you do now about this wintertime mindset, do you have any, I guess, advice for Wyomingites that maybe want to lean into these positive aspects of the season?
Absolutely. So I tell people that they should try to cultivate their wintertime mindsets in their thoughts, their speech, and their actions. So when you go outside, what do you notice? What do you pay attention to? What are your thoughts? So when it snows, it's equally true that it means that you probably have to shovel your driveway and clear snow off of your car. And also that the snow can be incredibly beautiful, that it sort of makes the world quiet and muffled and peaceful. And then in terms of speech, I really encourage people to try not to make small talk by bashing the winter or the weather. Do people do this in Wyoming?
Constantly.
Yeah. So this is something that happens sort of everywhere I go that, you know, people like to connect, and we often connect by talking about the weather. And in the winter, that often means complaining about the weather. And so I think this sort of furthers this mindset that winter is a dreadful time of year that everybody hates. So I really encourage other people to sort of make small talk either in different ways or by focusing on the things that you like about the winter. You know, you really focus on sort of the opportunities that this winter is affording you rather than coming in saying like, oh, so sick of this snow, so sick of the cold. And then in actions, I encourage people to find the things in winter that they like to do. So if you're an outdoors person and you like to, you know, be really physically active, you know, maybe you try cross-country skiing. Maybe you buy the thermal underwear so that you can go running even during the winter. And if you're sort of not so outdoorsy or, you know, you prefer to do things at home, what are activities that you could do that it's, you know, a special time of year to do? A lot of people describe the winter as a really creative time of year, a time to do painting or pottery. I always like to say that, you know, having a positive wintertime mindset is not a cure for clinical seasonal depression. And it also does not suggest that if someone has clinical seasonal depression, that's their fault or they should just sort of snap out of it by changing their mindset. So I really think wintertime mindset is a tool that we can all use to enjoy and sort of flourish during the winter season a little bit more. But it's really important not to conflate these things with sort of clinical mental illness that require sort of a lot of different strategies to combat.
Well, thanks so much for your time today, Carrie. It's been really great talking with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Maggie. Great chatting with you.
That was researcher Carrie Leibowitz discussing her work on wintertime mindsets.
You know, the winter holidays are a busy time for Juan Pablo Mijares, As a violin luthier, he makes and restores instruments in the violin family. And this time of year, he's busy. Professional musicians are calling him as they get ready for holiday concerts, and college students home for winter break need him to repair and tune their instruments. The Mountain West News Bureau's Allie Budner brings us behind the scenes at his unique shop.
You have to be looking for Juan Mijares' violin shop to find it. The storefront is tucked deep behind an alleyway in downtown Colorado Springs. Small details make the place feel decidedly old world, from the carved wooden sign above the entrance to the plink of violin strings that serve as door chimes. Mijares says some of his customers declare the place is even otherworldly.
They compare this to the Harry Potter, the Diagon Alley or something like it. They walk in here and they go, wow, this is, you know, an amazing thing right here off the alley, and they don't expect it.
And what he does inside is magical. He turns pieces of wood and animal guts, hairs, and hide into delicate but durable musical instruments.
You're taking just $200 or $300 worth of wood, and you make it into maybe a $10,000 or $20,000 instrument that you can sell. So there's a lot of value created there, and then it lasts for 300 or 400 years.
Old and new instruments fill his entry room. Violins, violas, cellos, and even giant upright basses. The space has 14-foot-tall coffered ceilings for good acoustics.
So this is what we would call the showroom or the main room.
It's homey, with plush chairs and a sofa in the corner. And through another doorway, the workshop.
My favorite thing to do is the violin making. That's what I went to school for, was to be a maker. And business has gotten busy, so there's dealing with customers and repairs and sales. But I try to get in here really early where I can actually work on building violins.
He points to two panels of wood on his workbench, each carved in the classic shape of a violin silhouette.
Here's one that we're building, a viola, actually.
It's for his 19-year-old son. All five of his children and his wife play stringed instruments. One of the wood panels Mijares shows me has a sort of tiger stripe pattern in its grain, and he's already added a fine inlay of ebony called a purfling to highlight the outer edges of the shapes.
This is the back, which is made out of flamed maple material, and it's heavier, stronger wood for the back and the sides and the neck. And then the top is made out of spruce, which is a lighter, more resonant wood for the top.
He gives me an example of that resonance.
You can actually hear, if we tap the top, you can actually get a tone out of it.
He shows me a rack of chisels, planes, knives, and gouges. He says 95% of the tools he uses are hand tools for carving and inlaying wood. And he doesn't use any nails or screws to fasten the pieces, just glue.
That's one thing in a factory where they're just cranking out the instruments. They don't take the time to tune them and adjust them the way we can when we're building them one at a time. We can tune each instrument individually, and hopefully then you get a master instrument, a really fine instrument.
He loves making and restoring these fine instruments and says Colorado Springs has been a good home for his family and his business for the last 3 decades.
We wanted to find a place that didn't have a real established violin shop, but that had a professional symphony, you know, and a beautiful place to live.
It also has the mountains, and Mijares loves to ski.
I have a bad reputation. When there's a powder day, I close the door and I go ski. I just can't help it.
Of course, Mijares also loves playing the violin, but he'll be the first to say it's not his biggest talent.
I practice every day. I never seem to get any better, but I practice every morning because I just love, it's part of my, you know, my routine.
He plays me a bit of a Bach sonata on a violin he built himself.
I may not be famous or well-known, but just the idea that someone somewhere will be appreciating something that I did, maybe 100 or 200 years from now, that's kind of a nice thing.
And as for the longevity of his business?
My youngest little girl, who's only 10, she seems to be the one who's very good with her hands and always building and making things and gluing things. And she talks about taking over for me and kicking me out of the business, so we'll see.
Until then, Juan Mijares will be here with his wood, chisels, and glue. Unless, of course, it's a powder day. For the Mountain West News Bureau, I'm Allie Budner.
When it comes to a Christmas tree, there are a lot of choices out there. Maybe silver tinsel is your thing, or the classic fake plastic spruce. Or maybe you want to work for it and cut down the tree yourself. For Wyoming Public Radio's Maggie Mullen, that's her tradition, and this year we tagged along.
Before heading out on any adventure into the snowy woods, you always want to make sure you're prepared and have all the proper gear.
Do we have a saw? Yes.
We have a saw.
Do we need a hatchet?
I don't know. Do we need a hatchet? That's my boyfriend Grant and his roommate Bridger. The three of us are loading up my Subaru before we head out to the Snowy Range Mountains to cut down a tree in the Medicine Bow National Forest. We decide we probably don't need a hatchet.
Saw should be fine.
Do we have gloves?
We have gloves.
Do we have straps?
We have straps.
All right. So to the forest office.
Okay.
We're stopping by the agency so we can buy a permit. At $10 a tree, it's quite a bit cheaper than an artificial one or other real ones at Christmas tree stands. Aaron Voos is with the U.S. Forest Service. He says cutting down your own tree is getting more and more popular.
This forest, we sell around 2,000 each season.
Voos says even he and his own family cut down their own tree each year. And while they go out on private land owned by some friends, the tradition remains the same.
You know, you take it back to your house and there's a story that goes along with it.
And when it comes to keeping your tree green and fresh through the holiday season, Voos says it's a lot like getting a fresh bouquet of flowers.
Just trim off a little bit of the end, get it in water, keep it in water. You don't want it to dry out.
Now, you can't just go out and cut down any tree. There are lots of rules, like it can't be within 20 feet of any developed areas, like campgrounds or trailheads, and the tree can't be taller than 20 feet. Also,
we encourage people to take trees out of a group. And the reason for that is that that helps with the overall health of the forest by thinning out some of the smaller trees, which then enables the remaining trees to grow larger, you know, have more sunlight, have more water, more nutrients.
With that, the three of us hit the road. It's a perfect day for cutting down a tree. Chilly, but not too bad. When we arrive at the trailhead, we have it pretty much to ourselves since it's a weekday afternoon. Bridger says first, we have a decision to make.
We do have to decide Charlie Brown tree or like Hallmark movie tree.
I live in a pretty small apartment with lower ceilings, so I'm looking for something more on the compact end of things. While we're searching, we do some tree identification. That's because Bridger just happens to be a botanist.
This is a Douglas fir.
Or how do you know?
If you look at the cones, they have these little tags with these little W-shaped things coming out of them. And I always think of that as like Douglas the mouse is hiding in there.
But which one is considered more of a Christmas tree?
Any of the green ones?
It doesn't take long until we spot the perfect tree.
Yeah, this one seems great.
I really like this one, actually. It's a Douglas fir, and it's not too tall, but not too skimpy either. It's just right. Before we start to cut it down, Bridger suggests we start another tradition. Whoever can guess how old the tree is doesn't have to pay for the mulled wine we plan to have back at the warm and cozy tavern in town. Grant is skeptical, though. After all, Bridger does have a bit of an advantage.
I'm not making this bet with a botanist. Just asking to lose. I want to hear Bridger's bet first. That will make this fair.
I'm guessing this tree is 18 years.
What's yours?
19.
I'm going to go with 12. With our wages placed, Grant gets out the saw. It doesn't take long either.
That's it.
Wow, that was easy. Then it's time to count the rings and settle this bet. Bridger blows off the sawdust to get a closer look, and we can really smell the fresh pine then.
One, two right before that bright one.
Yeah.
Then the end of the bright one's 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. Only 10.
Maggie won!
Yep, I beat the botanist. The tree weighs 15 pounds tops, so it's a light load down the trail and a snap getting it up on the top of my car. The three of us agree it was a good excuse to get outside. Plus, it doesn't hurt that I won the bet. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Maggie Mullen.
When we come back, we'll wrap up the program with a pair of Christmas features. This is Open Spaces. Welcome back to Open Spaces. I'm Bob Beck.
And I'm Maggie Mullen. Every year, the City of Gillette and the Gillette News Record team up to host a City Holiday Lights Contest. People can nominate themselves, friends, or neighbors. Then, seniors from the Campbell County Senior Center go out and judge the holiday lights. Wyoming Public Radio's Catherine Wheeler brings us this holiday audio postcard from the judging.
Thank you, everybody. This is exciting. We're getting ready to go.
I'm Ann Rossi, the executive director of the Campbell County Senior Center. I've been doing it for 12 years now with the seniors. The newspaper will provide those addresses to the city. The city is awesome because they will then put them on GPS so we can find the houses easily. And we'll ask seniors to sign up to come out and judge the lights. And tonight we had 15 that were interested. And then we will divvy them up in the vehicles, and then boom, we all go out and take a look.
So what we're going to do is we're going to go through. Your navigator is going to write down the address and a couple little notes so we can remember what that particular house looked like.
Do I have paper?
The drivers are going to run out and get a picture. And everybody has about 6 houses you're going to look at. Before we even get back here, you need to decide your top 2 houses that you liked. So there'll be 10 of them. We'll put 10 of them up on the screen. We'll come back for hot chocolate and cookies, and of the 10, we'll pick the top 3.
I'm Mary Jo Youngland, and I'm always there for fun. the displays in the yard is what we're judging them by, and the lights and the theme. And the overall presentation of the lighting. I don't like a lot of clutter myself, but then a lot of the others, the more lights, the merrier. I just think that the center does so much for us and gives us so much. You know, we are very blessed as elders here. And here's our first one here. The main theme looks like it's in blues, wouldn't you say? Blues and golds, maybe? As far as the blinking of the lights and there's the changing of stars on the top ceiling. And then the trees are down below on the lawns are in gold. And it's kind of a silver. And it's not too much, but it's just a nice decoration, isn't it?
Are you guys ready?
We are, I think, aren't we?
Okay, well, let's put our next address in.
Oh, here. Oh, this is pretty. Well, it's got candy canes and trees. And they're all decorated in different colors. And we got some reindeer back here.
I'll take a quick picture.
Very homey.
So are they putting peppermint schnapps in there?
It was just fun to get out for an evening of something different.
Same house, just a different angle. That's the one I picked. With the train and the Santa and the reindeer on the roof.
Some of them don't drive. Some of them don't have that opportunity to get out in the city and see all the creativity and all the lights. And I think some of it brings them back to when they would decorate and their kids and their families. And I think just the creativity and how far things have come from when they were younger, going out and decorating or looking at lights and things like that. A lot of people get into doing it and they enjoy doing it, but I don't think they always realize the impact that it has on the community and the people that aren't able to decorate or don't have a house to do it, or maybe the extra dollars to invest in the lights and so on. And it just puts a huge smile on their face that I hope the people that take the time to do their decorations, I know it means a lot to them, but to know and to understand how much it means to a lot of other people.
That was Catherine Wheeler and Gillette from the Seniors Top 10 Selections. Fans voted for the People's Choice Award at the Gillette News Record and the City of Gillette's Facebook pages. That winner, along with the seniors' own top 3, will be announced on December 22nd.
Speaking of the 22nd, it's the 22nd year the Rocky Mountain Dance Theater in Cody hosted its annual Nutcracker. As Wyoming Public Radio's Camila Kudelska finds out, Cody's Nutcracker is all about inclusion and support from the community.
I grew up going to the Nutcracker every year. It wasn't truly Christmas time until my mom and I got dressed up and watched the ballet filled with Christmas spirit, beautiful sets, costumes, and the music. So when I found out that Cody has been putting on a Nutcracker performance for the past 22 years, I had to go. The music and the general storyline was the same, but there were all these parts that I had never seen before.
Most Nutcrackers don't have butterflies or candy canes, and we do. And it's actually very special. It really is. I think it's one of the things that makes our Nutcracker really magical.
That's Elizabeth Fernandez. She's the artistic and executive director of Rocky Mountain Dance Theater. Fernandez has a long history with dance. A Cody native, Fernandez went to college for dance, and she eventually decided she wanted to come back to Wyoming.
It was a tough decision in a lot of ways because it's difficult sometimes to have that outlet for those of us who are a little more artistic. But I decided that it was exactly the reason that I should come back here.
She founded the Rocky Mountain Dance Theater in Cody. Fernandez says she knew right away she needed to provide some kind of performance for the dancers.
And I realized that I wanted my dance students to have the feeling that I had in college of something that was special and that I was working for all the time. And really the most magical part of any dance company is the Nutcracker. And it was something I knew that could be sustainable here.
She certainly knows about the Nutcracker, and she's aware of the tweaks in the Cody Nutcracker's storyline. While there are auditions for the Nutcracker, there aren't any cuts. Fernandez says she makes sure there's a part for everyone who puts the work in.
We have a lot of young kids, and so there is this need to provide parts for a certain age group, and so I've created parts for those.
Besides the butterflies and the candy canes, other parts included an enchanted fairy, clowns, and even a dragon.
You have to provide the next step for every step. And so you've got the little ones moving into the intermediate, into the advanced.
This is part of the challenge of being a dance theater in Cody, a town of about 10,000 people. But Fernandez says in the past 20 years or so, this uniqueness to the Cody Nutcracker is what makes it so exciting for the dancers and the community.
In providing those steps, you have to find a way to put them into the story for it to make sense. And so that's really why our story is a little bit different.
I'm Sully Jackson, and I'm a senior in high school. I'm Clara and Dewdrop.
In the Nutcracker I've seen, Clara is played by a little girl and doesn't have a leadership part. But in Cody, she does.
We all know the parts, like for everything else, the part's always changing, so you can always aspire to be a part, and then it's really cool once you get there.
Jackson started ballet when she was 3 years old. She grew up dancing in the Nutcracker, moving up the tier to this year when she accompanied two guest artists from Ballet Arizona in a dance.
And I have never felt a feeling I feel like when I perform in front of people, especially on the stage, and putting countless hours in. Like, I did the calculations for my college applications, like 47 weeks out of the year I'm dancing. So
Jackson's like fellow dancer Emery Johnson chimes in.
It's as soon as you get onto the stage is when it, like, all the thrill happens, because like it's so nice just looking at the audience and seeing how many like people from our community came to watch.
And the community's support is obvious. Throughout the entire show, the full auditorium cheered, laughed, and applauded every performer from the age of 3 all the way up to high school seniors. For Wyoming Public Radio, I'm Camila Kadalska at the Center of the West in Cody.
Thanks for listening to Open Spaces. If you missed the program and want to hear it again, you can find it and individual segments on our website at wyomingpublicmedia.org. Just click on Open Spaces.
You can also get our podcast, and all of our features and news stories can be found on our Facebook page. Anna Rader is our web editor.
Maggie and I wish all of you happy holidays and a tremendous new year. Open Spaces is a production of Wyoming Public Radio News.